Welcome to the Deep Dive. We sift through mountains of information on fascinating people and topics and basically give you everything you need to know fast.
Yeah, saving you all those hours of digging.
And today, we're diving deep into an actor who really is a master of transformation, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Absolutely. We're looking at someone whose range is just, it's staggering. We've got sources covering pretty much his entire life and career.
Childhood, his training, acting, directing.
Right. Even his music and writing, believe it or not. And his current big roles, of course.
He doesn't really have a consistent persona, does he?
Yeah.
It's more like a whole gallery of different people. Some sensitive, some deeply unsettling.
And he just disappears. The ultimate chameleon.
So our mission today is to unpack how he does that. What's the common thread? What fuels that intense commitment over, what, 4 decades now?
And it's an intensity that definitely took its toll on him at times, physically and maybe mentally too. We need to explore that drive.
Okay, to give you a feel for the kind of transformations we're talking about, let's just quickly mention 3 roles. Roles you probably know, but maybe didn't connect to the same actor.
Good idea. First up, Private Leonard Lawrence. You know, Gomer Pyle from Full Metal Jacket back in 87.
That tragic figure, a role that involved this just unbelievable physical change.
Yes.
Career-defining stuff.
Then, completely different, you've got Edgar the Bug in Men in Black. That creepy, awkward, hilarious alien in a farmer suit from 97.
So grotesque, but weirdly funny. He actually won a Saturn Award for that one.
He did. And then, for TV, you have these 2 huge anchors. First, Detective Robert Goren on Law & Order, Criminal Intent, hyper smart, kind of tortured.
He played him for what, over 100 episodes?
141 episodes, yeah. And then you contrast that with his current defining villain role, Wilson Fisk, Kingpin.
The big bad of the Marvel street level universe now.
Yeah.
That huge, imposing, but somehow vulnerable crime boss.
Right. To swing between that quiet, brainy detective and this powerhouse villain, that takes incredible control.
It really does. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's unpack this transformation artist. Where did it all start?
All right, let's lay the groundwork. Vincent Philip D'Onofrio, born June 30th, 1959 in Brooklyn, New York. Sources point out his Italian roots, ancestors from Naples.
And performance was kind of in the family background, wasn't it? Even if he wasn't aiming for the stage right away.
Exactly. His dad, Gennaro, or Gene, was an interior decorator, but his real passion was amateur theater. Spent all his spare time doing it.
So D'Onofrio grew up around theater making, not just watching, but actually doing stuff backstage.
Yeah, building sets, handling sound for community theaters his dad ran. He saw how the sausage was made, you know, understood the mechanics of creating that illusion early on.
And he moved around a bit as a kid.
He did.
Yeah.
Lived in Hawaii and Colorado when he was really young. Then his parents divorced and the family moved down near Hialeah, Florida.
And this is where he gets interesting. He's surrounded by theater, but he describes himself as shy.
Intensely shy, yeah. He said he spent a lot of time in my room staying in my head, which is fascinating, right? This internal world he was building.
That's key, isn't it? If you're naturally shy but drawn to performing, you kind of need a way in, a structure. And he found one early on with magic.
You got it. Sources mention this early fascination with magic, sleight of hand. Learned tricks from Cuban entertainers who had a little magic shop nearby.
Magic is all about control, technique, misdirection. Hiding the mechanics to create an effect.
It's a perfect parallel to method acting, really. Disappearing by mastering an internal technique.
So from that self-taught illusion, he moves into formal acting training after high school.
Right. He did some community stuff in Colorado, but the serious training kicked in back in New York. He went deep into method acting.
The famous schools?
Yep. The American Stanislavski Theater, the Actors Studio. Studied with big names like Sonia Moore and Sharon Chatton. He was really committing to the craft.
And this wasn't easy. He was hustling to make ends meet while training,
yeah.
Right? Doing NYU student plays, but also working some pretty wild jobs.
Oh, yeah, this part's great. Delivery guy, sure. Bouncer at the Hard Rock Cafe, okay. But then bodyguard work.
Seriously, for who?
Sources confirm it. Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin and Yul Brynner.
Wow. So he's got this physical presence guarding literal legends while training to sort of vanish emotionally into characters.
It's that mix, isn't it? Physical capability combined with intense internal discipline. That really set the stage.
And his stage career started picking up then.
It did. Got his first paid gig off Broadway in This Property is Condemned. Then Broadway in 84, a play called Open Admissions. He was building a solid foundation.
Okay, before we get to the role that completely changed everything, physically and professionally, let's touch on his personal life and some health stuff, because that seems really relevant to his whole approach.
Definitely. So in the late 80s, early 90s, he was with actress Greta Scacchi.
Right, and they have a daughter.
Yeah, Layla George, born around 92. She's an actress too. And here's a little Hollywood connection for you. Layla George was married to Sean Penn for a couple of years, 2020 to 2022.
Making D'Onofrio Sean Penn's former father-in-law for a bit, huh?
Small world. Then, in 97, he married Karen Vanderdonk, a Dutch model. They had a separation in the early 2000s, but got back together.
And they have kids, too.
Two sons, yeah. Born in 99 and 2008. It seems like it was a long, somewhat complicated relationship. He filed for divorce relatively recently, in June 2023.
Okay, and what about the health challenges he's mentioned? Those seem really significant.
They do. Sources confirm he has dyslexia. And he also said something really candid back in 2011.
What was that?
He reflected that if we knew more about conditions like autism back when he was a kid, he thinks he might have been diagnosed with it.
That adds a whole other layer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That self-described shyness, the dyslexia, maybe processing things differently, it makes his dedication to method acting seem less like just a choice and more
like a necessary tool, a way to build a predictable structure for himself to navigate the world and especially performance.
Exactly. Creating these detailed internal worlds wasn't just art. Maybe it was how he needed to operate to connect and perform so powerfully.
That meticulous internal construction really sets the scene perfectly for the role that blew the doors open.
Full Metal Jacket. Stanley Kubrick, 1987. You can't just call it a breakthrough. It was more like an explosion. Mm-hmm. Private Leonard Gomer Pyle Lawrence.
And getting the role itself was a feat of persistence. His friend, Matthew Modine, who was already cast, told him to send audition takes to Kubrick over in England.
Kubrick, famously hard to reach.
Right. D'Onofrio didn't send one tape, he sent four. He just kept sending them until Kubrick finally said yes.
And Kubrick's vision for the character changed, didn't it? Which changed everything for D'Onofrio.
Massively. Originally, the character was written as like a skinny, ignorant redneck type. Mm. But Kubrick decided the character's breakdown would be way more impactful, more horrifying if he was physically large, awkward, clumsy.
So he needed D'Onofrio to get big.
Really big. This led to one of the most famous weight gains in movie history. D'Onofrio put on 70 pounds. 70.
He ballooned up to 280 pounds for the part. At the time, that was the record, right?
It was. More weight than any actor had ever gained for a role up to that point. It wasn't just getting heavier. It was a complete physical overhaul to fit Kubrick's very specific, disturbing vision.
That level of commitment, especially that early in your career, it's almost like self-harm in service of the art. And it had real consequences.
Oh, absolutely. The physical toll was immediate and serious. While they were filming that brutal obstacle course scene, he badly injured his left knee.
And the extra weight just made it worse.
Way worse. Compounded the injury significantly. It ended up needing surgical reconstruction. So, yeah, his commitment literally broke his body.
And getting back to normal wasn't quick either.
Took him 9 full months after filming ended to lose almost all that weight. That one role just instantly defined him, not just talented, but willing to endure extremes most actors wouldn't even consider.
It really set the tone for his whole career, didn't it? If the part needs a massive change, internal or external, he'll do it, no matter the cost.
No, totally. He was suddenly in this category of, like, extreme dedication. So once he recovered physically, the challenge was clear. Prove he wasn't just the Full Metal Jacket guy.
He needed to show range, fast.
And he did. He immediately started taking diverse supporting roles. The same year Full Metal Jacket came out, 87, he's Dawson, the mechanic in Adventures in Babysitting.
Then the next year, 88, he's the sweet fiancé in Mystic Pizza. Completely different vibe. Charming, supportive.
Right. Showing he could be present without being this looming, tragic figure. Then he did more thoughtful roles, like in Robert Altman's The Player in 92.
He played the writer, David Kahan.
Yeah. He was just popping up everywhere, playing all sorts of different people.
In the 90s and early 2000s, saw him really dive into playing intense historical figures, roles that needed serious prep.
Like Robert E. Howard, the guy who created Conan the Barbarian and The Whole Wide World in 96. That was based on a memoir.
And that role got him noticed, right?
Yeah.
Awards.
It did. Best actor at the Seattle Film Festival, Lone Star Film Awards. And crucially, he wasn't just acting in it. He was a producer, too, showing that desire for more creative control.
He also played Abby Hoffman, the activist, in Steal This Movie, mm-hmm. in 2000.
Yep. But the historical role that had the most interesting fallout, leading to later work, was playing Orson Welles in Tim Burton's Ed Wood. That was 94.
Ah, yes. The voice incident. What happened there?
Well, he got the part, but Tim Burton apparently wasn't happy with his vocal performance as Welles. D'Onofrio later said he only had about 2 weeks to prep the voice.
So what did Burton do?
He had D'Onofrio's voice dubbed over by Maurice LaMarche, a well-known voice actor.
Ouch. That had to sting, being dubbed over.
Deeply. That artistic rejection clearly stuck with him. It became a major motivation for something he did later behind the camera. We definitely need to come back to that when we talk about his directing.
Okay. So besides the historical and sensitive roles, he also leaned into the totally bizarre sci-fi horror, where that physical control became a huge asset.
Yeah, you absolutely have to talk about Edgar the Bug in Men in Black. That performance is pure physical control.
He's playing this farmer whose body is taken over by this giant, gross alien cockroach.
And it's the way he moves. It's not just clumsy. It looks fundamentally wrong. Like, the body doesn't fit. That jerky, insect-like walk, the hunched posture, the face stretched into these awful smiles.
It's repulsive, but also kind of hilarious because the human form is clearly struggling. That Saturn Award makes total sense.
Totally earned. Then you have Carl Starger in The Cell in 2000, playing a serial killer opposite J-Lo, mostly inside these surreal dreamscapes.
That was pure psychological horror, quiet, chilling menace. He got nominated for Best Villain at the MTV Movie Awards for that and won a Fangoria Chainsaw Award. He can flip from physical comedy to just dark terror.
And he kept working in big movies, too. Like, he was Vic Hoskins in Jurassic World in 2015.
He's kind of shady security guy.
Right. And Jack Horn in the remake of The Magnificent Seven in 2016.
Yeah.
The quiet mountain man tracker. Even in huge ensembles, he brings this weight and complexity.
But I think for a whole generation, maybe two generations, his face and that intense method became synonymous with television. Two massive long-running roles.
Absolutely. We have to spend real time on Detective Robert Gorin, Law & Order, Criminal Intent. He was Gorin from 2001 to 2011, 141 episodes. That character was him for a decade in the public eye.
Gorin was such a perfect fit for D'Onofrio's specific kind of intensity, wasn't he? Not a tough street cop, but this super smart, incredibly observant guy.
Totally cerebral. His whole method was about soaking up details and making these incredible intuitive leaps. Almost like that autism connection you mentioned earlier, that ability to see patterns others miss.
And his physicality as Gorin was so distinct. That hunched way he'd examine things, how he'd lean into suspects, was unsettling.
Yeah, if we think back to that shy kid needing structure, Gorin is like the ultimate constructed persona. His weird mannerisms, the way he'd almost physically grapple with clues. And D'Onofrio built this character who used his brain like a physical force.
But keeping that level of intensity up for a network TV show schedule,
yeah,
that sounds exhausting.
It proved to be almost impossible. Those Law & Order shows have brutal schedules, like 14-hour days, week after week. He was trying to bring deep method work to a factory production line.
And it led to actual physical problems.
Sources confirm it. Back in 2004, he actually collapsed twice. Once on set, once at home, just sheer exhaustion.
Wow, that wasn't just being tired. That was his body giving out from maintaining Gorin's mental state constantly.
It really speaks to how immersed he was. He wasn't just saying the lines. He was living that high-stress internal world.
And that probably played into the changes on the show later.
Seems likely. His departure was announced in 2009. Jeff Goldblum came in, but the ratings dipped noticeably.
People miss Gorin's unique energy.
Exactly. So they brought him and Catherine Irby back for the final season, season 10, to wrap it up properly.
And he had fun with the character's fame, too, right? Didn't he do SNL?
Yeah, a funny cameo as Gorin in a presidential election sketch in 2008, complete with the iconic Dundee-Owen sound effect. It showed Gorin had become this recognizable cultural figure.
Okay, so if Gorin was his procedural anchor, Wilson Fisk, Kingpin, is his huge current anchor in the whole superhero world.
Right.
This is the role defining him for a new generation.
Definitely. He first showed up as Fisk in Marvel's Daredevil series back in 2015, and right away it was different.
How so? He wasn't just a typical comic book bad guy.
Not at all. D'Onofrio played him as this deeply damaged man-child. Someone twisted by trauma into this terrifying, calculated monster, but with this core of vulnerability that could just explode into rage.
That performance was instantly iconic. What makes it work so well?
It's the stillness. He's this huge, physically imposing guy, but often his power comes from being quiet. He speaks in this soft, almost hesitant whisper sometimes.
Which makes it even more terrifying.
Exactly. It forces you to lean in, makes the moments of violence even more shocking. He contrasts the physical size with this contained, simmering emotion. It's all internal calculation.
And Marvel clearly loved it because Fisk keeps showing up everywhere now.
Yeah, that portrayal was so strong, he's become central to their street-level stories. He came back in Hawkeye in 2021, got a Critics' Choice Super Award nomination for Best Villain for that.
Then Echo in 2024. And the big one coming up is Daredevil. Born again in 2025, he is Kingpin now.
It's fascinating, too, because while he's playing this iconic fictional villain, he's also playing a real-life historical gangster at the same time.
Right. Vincent the Chin Gigante and Godfather of Harlem since 2019.
So he's switching between the real-life mob boss, the super smart TV detective, and the comic book kingpin.
What's the common thread there?
It always seems to come back to finding the internal wound, the driving force of the character, whether they're real or imagined, that intense commitment to the inner life.
Okay, so with that much intensity going into his acting, where does all the other creative energy go? Especially since we know he started out building sets and stuff.
Great question. It goes behind the camera and into some pretty unexpected places.
He's a genuine multitasker then. Yeah. Director, producer?
Director, producer, writer, even musician. We mentioned he produced The Whole Wide World back in 96.
But the directing project that really tells us something about his psychology is that Orson Welles short film, right?
Yeah.
5 minutes, Mr. Welles.
Yes, from 2005. This film exists purely because he was so bothered by having his voice dubbed in Ed Wood all those years earlier.
He made a whole film just to prove he could do the Welles voice.
Pretty much. He wrote it, produced it, directed it, and starred as Welles, specifically showing Welles prepping for The Third Man. It was his way of saying, see, I can do this. It's pure artistic vindication, an amazing insight into his drive.
That's incredible dedication to settling a score, artistically speaking. What else has he directed?
He directed a feature called Don't Go in the Woods in 2010,
yes.
Which was, get this, a musical slasher film.
A musical slasher, seriously.
Yeah.
With his own music.
Yep, talk about genre bending. Apparently shot super fast, like 13 days, tiny budget. Shows a real willingness to experiment. He also directed a more straightforward Western called The Kid in 2019, starring alongside Dane DeHaan.
Okay, musical slashers are weird. But his actual music career gets even stranger, doesn't it?
Oh, buckle up for George Geronimo Gerke.
George Geronimo Gerke? Who's that?
That was D'Onofrio's comedic country singer, alter ego. He actually performed as Gerke in New York clubs, like Joe's Pub, around 2009-2010.
While he was playing the intense detective Gorin on TV, that's quite a contrast.
Exactly. A total release valve, maybe?
Mm.
What's really interesting, though, is that the money raised from those Gerke concerts went to something called the Utah Meth Cops Project.
So even his weird country alter ego tied back into his support for law enforcement.
It did. Connecting the bizarre art project to his civic side. He also did some avant-garde spoken word stuff later in 2014 with a musician named Dana Lynn. One single was called I'm a Hamster.
I'm a Hamster. Okay. That tracks with the creator of Gorin somehow.
Doesn't it? And he's a writer, too. Published a children's book in 2023, Pigs Can't Look Up.
Based on a tweet.
Yeah, apparently based on a viral tweet he made about pigs and kindness. He just seems to have this constant need to create in whatever form.
And voice acting, too. For video games.
Right. He voiced the villain Duke Luca Abel in the game Dishonored 2 in 2016. And the sources note he really drew on his acting background, thinking about political manipulation, to make the Duke's speeches sound authentic and corrupt. He brings the same level of detail everywhere.
It all points to this relentless creative drive that isn't just about acting. It spills over into everything, including his advocacy work.
Absolutely. That commitment is just as strong in his civic life, which has been a really consistent part of his career, especially later on.
Like founding a film festival.
Yeah. Way back in 98, he, his dad, and his sister Elizabeth started the River Run International Film Festival in North Carolina. It's still going strong, focusing on independent film, keeps him connected to that community.
But his biggest public service role seems linked to law enforcement, maybe stemming from all those years as Gorin.
Definitely seems connected. Since 2010, he's been the official spokesperson for the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund and Museum.
That's a long-term commitment.
It is. He narrated a documentary called Heroes Behind the Badge in 2012 and a sequel with proceeds going to the memorial in D.C. It feels like genuine, sustained support, not just a celebrity endorsement.
And he got involved with specific causes, too, like that Utah project.
Right. The Utah Meth Cops Project, from around 2009 to 2012, He hosted events, acted as spokesperson, raising money for detox programs specifically for officers dealing with the fallout of that crisis.
He also took a public stance on gun control.
He did. In 2011, he was in an ad for the Citizens Crime Commission of New York City, calling for a ban on large-capacity ammo magazines. He uses his platform for issues he cares about.
And through all this, he still goes back to the stage. Back to theater.
Consistently. In 2012-2013, he did an off-Broadway play called Clive with Brooks Ashmanskas and Zoe Kazan. It was directed by Ethan Hawke, who he's worked with a lot. He always returns to that foundation, that source of his technique.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, we followed Vincent D'Onofrio from being this shy kid in Brooklyn, finding refuge in magic and method acting.
Through that absolutely body-breaking role for Kubrick.
To becoming one of the most versatile, intense, and sometimes downright scary character actors out there today.
Yeah, our deep dive really shows an artist whose whole identity is built on total immersion and maybe a deep need for structure. That ability to meticulously build a character physically, vocally, emotionally seems rooted in his own way of processing the world.
It allows him to bridge that gap, that shyness, and create these unforgettable people, whether it's the sensitive writer Howard, the creepy Edgar Bug, or that terrifyingly wounded monster Kingpin. He builds their entire internal reality.
He's such a contradiction, isn't he? Nearly wrecks himself for one role, then finds the stamina for 141 episodes of TV intensity, then blows off steam playing a joke country singer and making indie films.
And directing a film specifically to prove a point about a voice performance from 10 years earlier?
Yeah.
It all comes from the same intense dedication.
Exactly. So here's something final for you, the listener, to think about. Consider how those early challenges D'Onofrio talked about, the shyness, the magic, the dyslexia, weren't maybe obstacles to his acting, but actually the engine driving his specific, punishingly intense method approach.
Maybe his power comes precisely because he has to meticulously construct connection, rather than just relying on easy charisma.
Right. And if you want to see that obsessive commitment in action, maybe check out that short film he made, 5 Minutes, Mr. Wells. It's a fascinating glimpse of an artist needing to publicly correct the record, to perfect his craft long after most people would have moved on.
It really is the mark of a true master of transformation.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the incredible, intense career of Vincent D'Onofrio.
We'll catch you next time.